might even now belong to that great power. And to anyone who has sailed from Honolulu to Yokohama or to Shanghai, these islands lie perilously close to Japan and China. For more than half a century, I have believed that their destiny lies with America, but it is not, as I once thought, an inevitable destiny. If at this crucial moment of history our logical destiny is frustrated, an illogical one will triumph, and Hawaii, the gem of the Pacific, will belong to Canada, or to Russia, or to Japan. It is to prevent such a catastrophe that we pray for the United States to accept us now. This widely reprinted article was taken from the Hale Mansion on King Street by Wild Whip Hawksworth and delivered to one of his ships waiting in the harbor. But as old Micah Hale handed it to his nephew, he was freshly appalled that he should be using such an evil agent to accomplish so good a purpose. Micah's plea achieved nothing, for Louisiana and Colorado sugar interests prevented the lame duck Senate of February 1893 from jamming the Treaty of Annexation through. And 5 days after Grover Cleveland assumed the presidency, he sternly withdrew the treaty and rebuked those who had sought to foist it upon the American public. Now, doleful news reached Hawaii. The Secretary of State wrote, "The United States will not accept the Hawaiian Islands on the terms under which they have been offered. It would lower our national standard to endorse a selfish and dishonorable scheme of a lot of adventurers. I oppose taking these islands by force and fraud, for there is such a thing as international morality." President Cleveland was of a similar opinion and personally dispatched an investigator to Honolulu to inquire into America's role in the unsavory revolution. And by one of the tricks of history, the investigator turned out to be a Democrat from Georgia and a member of a family that had once held slaves. When preliminary news of his appointment reached Hawaii, the Committee of Nine were apprehensive lest he report against them. But when his slaveholding status was revealed, they sighed with visible relief. "As a good Southerner, he'll understand our problems," John Janders told the conspirators, and they all agreed. But Whip Hawksworth, considering the matter carefully, judged, "We may be in for deep trouble. Since Cleveland's investigator comes from Georgia, he probably despises niggers." "Of course he does," Janders agreed. "He'll see through these Hawaiians right away." "I doubt it," Whip cautioned. "Granted that he hates niggers, as a sensible human being, he'll try to compensate and prove that he doesn't hate other people with dark skins." "Why would he do that?" Janders demanded. "Don't ask me why," Whip replied. "Just watch." And when the investigator arrived, he did exactly as Whip had predicted. Hating Negroes at home, he had to like Hawaiians abroad. It was a profound compulsion, and it permitted him, a Georgia man, to understand the revolution better than any other American understood it at the time. He talked principally with Hawaiians, was bedazzled by the idea of speaking directly with a queen, became an ardent royalist, and suppressed evidence given by white men. His report to President Cleveland was a crushing rebuke to the sugar men. They had, he discovered, conspired with the American minister to overthrow a duly constituted government. They had worked in league with the captain of an American vessel. They had deposed the queen against the will of the Hawaiian people. They had done all this for personal gain. And it was his opinion that Queen Liliuokalani, a virtuous woman, should be restored to her throne. His report aroused such a storm in Washington that David Hale and Micah Whipple saw there was no hope of forcing the United States to accept Hawaii, and they returned to Honolulu with a glum prediction. "We will never become part of America while Grover Cleveland is president. His Secretary of State is already asking, should not the great wrong done to a feeble state by an abuse of the authority of the United States be undone by restoring the legitimate government? There's even talk of restoring the Queen by force of American arms." What would happen to us? Members of the committee asked. Since you're American subjects, a consular official explained, you'd be arrested, hauled off to Washington, and tried for conspiring to overthrow a friendly power. Oh, no, the conspirators protested. We're Hawaiian subjects. Our citizenship is here. September and October 1893 were uneasy months in Hawaii, and Wild Whip's gang maintained power by only a nervous margin. Each arriving ship brought ominous news from Washington, where sentiment had swung strongly in favor of Queen Liliuokalani, and it was generally assumed that she would shortly be restored to power. But just before this was about to occur, the obstinate woman committed an act so appalling to the Americans that she forever discredited the monarchy. What Wild Whip had been unable to gain for himself, the Queen won for him. Late in the year, President Cleveland dispatched a second investigator to check upon the specific terms under which Liliuokalani should be returned to her throne, for as Cleveland pointed out, America never wished to profit from the misfortunes of her neighbors. The new investigator plunged the Committee of Nine into despair by announcing that the annexation of Hawaii by America was no longer even under discussion, whereupon he entered into formal discussions with the Queen as to what steps she wanted America to take in restoring her crown. No difficulties were encountered, and the investigator had to smile when the Queen pointed out, "One of the charges made against us most often, sir, was that we were a small kingdom, overly given to a love of luxurious display. To this charge I must plead guilty, because from the first our king selected as their advisers men of the missionary group, and we found that no men on earth love panoply and richly caparisoned horses and bright uniforms and medals more than men who have long been dressed in New England homespun. I have four pictures here of state occasions. You see the men loaded with gold and medals. They aren't Hawaiians, they're Americans. They demanded the pomp of royalty, and we pampered them." "Speaking of the Americans," the investigator asked, "what kind of amnesty will you provide for the revolutionists?" "Amnesty?" Queen Liliuokalani asked, inclining her large and expressive head toward the American. "I don't understand." "Amnesty," the investigator explained condescendingly. "It means..." "I know what the word means," Liliuokalani interrupted, "but what does it mean in this circumstance?" "Hawaii's undergone some unfortunate trouble. It's over. You're restored to your throne. President Cleveland assumes that you'll issue a proclamation of general amnesty. It's usually done." "Amnesty?" the powerful queen repeated incredulously. "If not amnesty, what did you have in mind?" "Beheading, of course," the queen replied. "What was that?" "The rebels will have to be beheaded. It's the custom of the islands. He who acts against the throne is beheaded." The American investigator gasped, then swallowed hard. "Your Excellency," he said, "are you aware that there are over 60 American citizens involved?" "I did not know the number of traitors, and I do not think of them as Americans. They have always claimed to be Hawaiians, and they shall be beheaded." "All 60?" the investigator asked. "Why not?" Liliuokalani asked. "I think I had better report to President Cleveland," the perspiring investigator gulped, excusing himself from the august presence. And that night he wrote, "There are factors here which we may not have considered adequately in the past." After that, there was no more talk of restoring the monarchy. Thus, in late 1893, it became apparent that the United States would neither accept Hawaii in view of the besmirched character of the men who had led the revolution, nor restore a monarchy that threatened to behead more than 60 American citizens. So the islands drifted year by year, ships without moorings. Hawaiians grew to hate the Haoles who had defrauded them of their monarchy, and Haoles despised the weak-kneed American senators who refused to accept their responsibilities and annex the islands. Sugar planters suffered, and it looked as if Colorado and Louisiana would keep Hawaiian sugar out of the mainland permanently. The great ships of the H&H carried less cargo, and both the British and the Japanese began wondering what indecency they ought to do about this rudderless ship drifting across the dangerous Pacific. In desperation, the sugar men proposed a treaty which would allow them to peddle their accumulating sugar to Australia, and it was predicted that Hawaii would soon have to join the British Empire. At this juncture, Micah Hale saved Hawaii, and he was well prepared for his role. Years before in Lahaina, his missionary father had kept him penned up in a walled garden where he had done nothing but study history, the Bible, and his father's fierce sense of rectitude. Particularly, he had served two apprenticeships, which now fortified him in the job of building a new government. He had watched his father translate the book of Ezekiel, so that the stern phrases of that obdurate prophet lived in his mind. And he had listened when his lame little father explained how John Calvin and Theodore Beza had governed Geneva in accordance with the will of God. The first thing Micah Hale did was to deprive Wild Whip Hawksworth of any connection with the government. Next, he insisted upon moral laws and fiscal responsibility. But above all, like a true missionary, he wrote. For the newspapers, he wrote justifications of his government. For magazines, he explained why the Hawaii Revolution, which he had not wanted, was similar to the uprisings that had brought William and Mary to the English throne. To Republican senators, he wrote voluminously, providing them with ammunition to be fired against the Democrats. And to long-forgotten friends across America, he wrote inspired letters, begging them to accept Hawaii. He lived solely for the purpose of making his islands part of the United States, and his pen, as it pushed across paper in the quiet hours after midnight, was the only real weapon the islanders had left. It was not a liberal government that Micah founded. When the wealthy men who were to draw up a new constitution met, he lectured, "Your job is to build a Christian state in which only responsible men of good reputation and solid ownership of property are allowed to govern." Explicit property qualifications were set for all who served and all who voted to have them serve. No man could be a member of the Senate who did not own $3,000 worth of property untouched by mortgages, or who did not possess a yearly income of $1,200. In order to vote for a senator, a man was required to own $3,000 worth of property or to have an income of $600. Explained Micah, "In other parts of the world, the uneducated working man raises his voice in anger against his superiors, but not in Hawaii." Wherever possible, advantages were given to plantation owners, for upon them rested the welfare of the islands. On one point, Micah was adamant. No Oriental must be allowed to vote or to participate in the government in any way. They were brought to these islands to labor in the cane fields, and when their work was done, they were supposed to go back home. There was no intention that they stay here, and if they do so, there is no place in our public life for them. Therefore, at Micah's suggestion, cleverly worded literacy tests were required for suffrage, and no Chinese or Japanese, even if he were wealthy and a citizen, could possibly pass them. In many respects, Micah's government was too liberal for the sugar men who had thrown it into power, and there were many Hales and Whipples and Hewletts among the missionary group who opposed his radical liberalism, while the Janderses and Hawksworths considered him insane with French Republican principles. For once the electorate had been restricted to the well-to-do, Micah was lenient and just in all other matters. He insisted upon trial by jury, the rights of habeas corpus, freedom of religion, and all the appurtenances of an Anglo-Saxon democracy. But when in the later stages of the Constitutional Convention he was asked, "What kind of government are you building here?" he replied quickly, "One that will mark time decently until the United States accepts us." From this great basic principle, he never wavered. A lesser man than Micah might have been tempted by his power, but this austere New Englander was not. He awarded himself no medals, erected no fanciful structures of power about his erect, white-suited figure. In the 5 years following the Revolution of 1893, this ordained minister never once let a day pass without getting down on his knees and praying, Almighty God, bring our plan to fruition. Make us part of America. Micah's training as a Calvinist enabled him to face many crises with an absolute conviction that he was right, and when ugly decisions had to be made, he was willing to make them. In 1895, an armed revolution broke out against his government, and with unequivocating force he put it down, then arrested Queen Liliuokalani for her supposed complicity in it. When weak-livered men counseled caution in dealing with the fiery queen, Micah said, She will be tried on charges of treason against this republic. And he stood firm when a jury, subservient to the sugar man, brought in a verdict of guilty. Of course, any other jury would have had to do the same, for the queen, refusing to honor the usurpers from America who had stolen her throne, naturally worked against them. And although there were conflicting reports on the matter, probably also encouraged her followers to open rebellion. The new nation had no recourse but to try her for treason, and when the sugar men found her guilty, it was Micah's responsibility to imprison her. The powerful, headstrong woman was incarcerated in an upper room of the palace, and while her imprisonment was rigorously policed, it was never physically unpleasant. And before long, her adherents were circulating the greatest state paper ever produced by a sovereign of the islands. It was a song, transcribed by Liliuokalani while in prison, and although she had composed it some years before, it had gained little notice. Now its lament swept the island and the world. Aloha oi, gently sweeps the rain cloud o'er the cliff, borne swiftly by the western gale. One of the missionary men said of this song, While she was free, Queen Liliuokalani never did a thing for her people, but when she was in jail, she expressed their soul. Micah Hale, hearing the melody, said, Let her go free. And she left for Washington, there to fight against him bitterly. When the revolution was put down and the new government stabilized, it seemed for a brief interval as if President Cleveland and the Democrats might accept Hawaii. Mainland newspapers were beginning to write, The moral stature of Micah Hale has gone far to correct the evils perpetrated by younger Americans during the revolution. At last, Micah reported to his cabinet, I am beginning to see hope. And then, Wild Whip Hawksworth exploded across the front pages of America, and editors wrote, This violent young man has served to remind us of the viciousness whereby men like himself stole Hawaii from Queen Liliuokalani. And hope of annexation evaporated. The trouble started during a 3-day orgy at a Chinese brothel on Rat Alley in Iwilei. Whip had driven down to see a Spanish girl picked off a ship just in from Valparaiso, and he was enjoying himself when one of the sailors from the ship appeared with a claim that the girl belonged to him by right of purchase. A dreadful brawl ensued, in which the intruding sailor was well whipped and kicked about the face. When he recovered, he stormed back into the brothel, with two friends armed with knives, and they started to carve pieces out of Whip's face. But the Valparaiso girl sided with Whip and crashed a stool into the face of the leader, who, already weak from the beating Whip had earlier administered, collapsed, whereupon Whip kicked him about the head so furiously that the man nearly died. Wild Whip was not arrested, of course, not only because the affair had happened in Iwilei, which was more or less outside police jurisdiction, but also because there were many witnesses to the fact that three men had come at him with knives, and he had two scars to prove that they had cut him before he had manhandled them. This affair might have passed without more than local notice, except that the wounded sailor was a man of obstinate character, and as soon as he was discharged from the hospital, he bought himself a gun, waited for Whip in a Hotel Street bar, and shot him through the left shoulder as he walked by. It was news of this shooting that reached America, where it vitiated much that Micah Hale had been accomplishing. But insofar as Hawaii was concerned, the worst was yet to come. For at the height of the scandal, Wild Whip got married. And this was almost insupportable, for the girl he married, with his left arm in a sling, was May Forbes. She was a beautiful girl of 20, with long black hair, sinewy charm, and perfect complexion. She had a soft, low voice, and was known to be of impeccable reputation, for her father, recognizing her beauty, had brought her up with extra care. Normally, the marriage of a vigorous young man like Wild Whip to a beautiful girl like May Forbes would have been acclaimed, especially as it was a love match, and there was some hope that May might tame the fiery Hawksworth. Instead, the marriage was so offensive to Hawaii that it overshadowed all of Wild Whip's former behavior, because May Forbes sprang from a rather curious parentage. Her grandmother was the daughter of one of the lesser Ali'i families from Maui, and her grandfather, Josiah Forbes, was a strong-minded, able Englishman from Bristol, who had jumped ship on the Big Island to make a small fortune pressing sugar. Later, he married his Maui sweetheart, a fine Hawaiian woman, and they had a pert daughter. But she was a headstrong girl who liked to do as she wished, and at the age of 19, she married a Chinese farmer named Ching, so that her daughter, who went by the name of May Forbes, was really Ching Lan Tsin, Perfect Flower Ching, and her marriage to Whipple Hawksworth was the first example of an Oriental, or part Oriental in her case, marrying into a major island family. It was a terrifying foretaste of the future, and Wild Whip was ostracized. Even though his behavior had damaged Hawaii, he would probably have been allowed to remain in the islands, except for a public brawl he engaged in with the Hewlett boys. It arose when he found that some of the Committee of Nine had developed second thoughts about the revolution and were now preaching against union with America. Somebody pointed out that as soon as we come under American law, our contracts for forced labor will be declared void, and we won't be free to import any more Japanese. "Anything wrong with that?" Whip asked scornfully. "How can we grow sugar without contract labor?" "Frankly, and all sentiment aside, what good does contract labor do you?" "Well, they've got to work where we say at a fixed wage, and if they don't, we can depend on our judges to make them." "Well, I'll be goddamned," Whip snorted. "Don't you men ever read the papers? Of course our labor laws will be rejected by America." "Then we don't want to join America," one of the Hewlett boys said. "What do you propose?" Whip asked politely. "Join England. She allows contract labor. Or go it alone." Whip was stunned. The revolution was slipping away from him. First, Cleveland frustrated it, and now the original conspirators were talking of union with England. "Look," he said carefully, "you don't need the old labor contracts. For the last 11 years, I've not dragged one of my men into court. If they want to leave, okay. I give them good food, a fair deal, a little humor, and they make more sugar for me than they do for all of you put together.